Hi, everyone. My name is Petra. I'm an alcoholic from Richmond. I want to thank you all for the warm welcome. What a delight to drive up here. You know, what a beautiful day, and what a great reminder that God still has purpose for me. And I am here today being a sober woman, and I'm grateful for that. My sobriety date is the 1st of January 2012. I have a sponsor who is also sponsored. My sponsor knows that I am her sponsee. I talk to her at least 3 times a week. I enjoy her company, and I think, I like to believe she enjoys mine. I also sponsor women, which is a real privilege. I've had the pleasure of sponsoring international, and this morning got to talk to a Russian woman who lives in Spain, and this is just, what a reminder, a beautiful reminder of how interconnected we all are. And at this time, I just want to take a nice deep breath, because a lot of Petra gets in the way sometimes, especially when I have an opportunity to share. So I just want to just ask my higher power to just center me, allow me to be a vehicle, a tool of the message for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not important how I look or what I think I need to share or what this needs to look like. So I just ask God to use me. Thank you. I was born in Germany. I had a family. My parents are not alcoholics. I have one brother who's also not an alcoholic, and I've seen very little drinking going on. As I was growing up, my family did not have parties. There was a little cabinet with some kind of cognac and things of that nature, just in case people would come, which sometimes my father had a home business as well as a regular job. And so there was that. But that stuff sat in there forever. And I think, I just remember me drinking out of it, nobody else ever really. Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about the willfulness that I've had that displayed all throughout my life, and I think that is one of those character defects or patterns or behaviors that we hear often about that sort of define us alcoholics, feeling different than and other apart from. And you know, I don't know if I felt that early on, but I do know that my entire childhood was infused by defiance early on. I mean, to a degree that my parents were really helpless and hopeless over me. That started at an early age with an incident where I stole money from my parents. My mom had sent me to the store. I remember her being really upset. It was probably the equivalent of $20. And I just decided to keep that and have a nice day out with one of my friends. I mean, I was 7 at the time, and I remember my mom being very upset about it and how very little concern I had for that. And I truly carried on with this entire, well, let me go back to the grocery store. And, you know, and this is maybe the first vivid memory of me just, and I don't even think that I thought of it as defiant or just conniving being just a liar and a thief. It was just, you know, it was so embedded in me. That's not behavior I've seen in my family. You know, both of my parents were upstanding citizens. They all went to work all the time. I had a brother who was very good in school, a bit of an introvert, and I was always a bit different. You know, I would seek out, as my father would say, the socially underprivileged. Economic underprivileged, you know, I would always take on these people that were sort of a project a little bit, even with friends. And this woman to this day is my friend. Her name is Uzi, and she was kind of picked on. She was a bit heavy set, so people, you know, she was an easy target. And I tell you, I just took her under my wing, and I beat up everybody who ever made fun of her. You know, so I was always sort of like, you know, I was protecting, and at the same time, you know, I was very defiant, you know. Anyway, so my early childhood behavior certainly was already some of that, just defiance. It's a really, you know, in itself will run riot, as I find out much later in the rooms that there is actually a way to describe that behavior. My drinking, probably my earliest memory drinking is from that bar. I think I was about 5 or 6. I was very responsible. Well, I was held responsible early. My parents worked weird shifts, so I had to take my brother to kindergarten before I went to first grade. So I think that sort of shaped me a little bit maybe too, where I found myself just being good, being responsible, you know, for those who probably weren't quite able yet to help themselves. I took that in my marriages later, and I didn't succeed. However, you know, so I remember having that drink and the lightheadedness that we often hear about, and sort of like it just kind of penetrated through every part of my body like a wave, you know, like a pulsing wave. I do remember that. And I don't think I speak that actively for a long time. I just do remember that incident. My drinking took off in high school. You know, I think like most of us, you know, that's and I think it's even true for non-alcoholics, where we find ourselves testing the limits, you know, not necessarily caring about boundaries. And I took that probably a little further. You know, I scared my parents a lot with the choices I made. I hitchhiked all around Europe, you know, hitchhiked to school in the morning, even though there was a bus, just so I could sleep a little longer. I dated outside the norm. You know, I was talking to Thurston, who also was in Europe. And, you know, the base was my home. Early on, I had a real desire to leave the super anal Germans behind, you know, and I don't know where that came from, but I found out much later that there must have been a few relatives in my family that also sought their good fortune in America, and they must be still here somewhere. But my family was a very small unit. There were some things going on in my family that, you know, that I think, you know, we wanted to keep maybe the family secret. There was some shaming going on, and I don't think it's important to go there, but the relationship of my parents was sometimes challenging. And so, you know, like I said, there was a bit of isolation even in the small village that I grew up. And I think I was early on trained to sort of like to kind of like stand up for those who are maybe not quite able to do for themselves, and then also to really not tell, looking good on the outside. You know, it's interesting, even when I go home now, my father is like behind the curtains looking out, and, you know, that kind of like really throws me way back. Yes, so my early days are really characterized by not paying attention to rules. You know, that, of course, in school, the same thing. You know, I was fairly smart, but I didn't care too much for learning. It was much more fun to hang out at the pool hall. And, you know, for as early as I can remember really drinking actively, I would hang out with people who, I think about Columbo all the time, trench coat, sort of like hunched over. That's the kind of people I wanted to drink with, you know. It wasn't, I hear many stories. Some people like to drink very classy. I was not a classy drinker, you know. I felt most welcomed by those, once again, who probably were feeling a bit outcast, I think. That's probably a good way to put it. Another memory that makes me stand out a bit, I guess you have not heard my story, but that's something I have to share all the time. In the small village where I lived, there were gypsies coming once a year. You know, we had the wagons and the pots, and they would jingle. And the gypsies had a reputation that you shouldn't get too close. They were probably not too honest. They would steal your husband and things of that nature. And everybody was sort of super hyper-vigilant, is a good way to put that. You know, and I ran to them, and I fell home, mostly in that little trailer, you know. And I just really, I loved the community that was represented, you know. And I think I thought that forever in all my relationships. And fast forward a little bit, you know, so my early teenage years characterized by not paying attention. So this now brings me to the man that I'm going to marry. I follow him to California, breaking my mother's heart. I'm 18. I have a baby on my hip, and I am walking through the gates. And to this day, she said, "You never even looked back at us and waved. You just kept moving forward." And I have five children, and I look at my youngest, who's 21, and I cannot believe that at that age, 3 years prior to that, I already had a child. There is, you know, but those, my entire youth was, and a big part of my adulthood was fused by decisions not regarding the consequences. Everything, I've involved myself in risk-taking and didn't even consider it risk-taking. I think I've labeled that adventure, and it was. You know, I liked the way I felt. And I was reading a little bit from a literature that's not approved, so I'm not going to mention the name, but it talks about how we clothe ourselves with these labels or how other people perceive us. And for me, it was really, I mean, one of my early idols was, oh my God, I can't think of the Rebel Without a Cause. James Dean. I was going to say Jimmy Dean, but he's a sausage maker, isn't he? So not that guy. But, you know, early Elvis Presley was stationed in the same barracks, not at the same time, obviously, but where I met my husband. I was always drawn to a bit of that edginess, you know, and that took me to California at the age of 18. And the moment I land, my husband had to go a little bit before I did. The moment I land, he picks me up, he drops me off at his dad's house where we would stay, and he left for 3 days. And so this was just, you know, insane from the very beginning. But I just, you know, I think a person who would probably have some kind of normal thought process would say, I want to go home. You know, this is not safe. I have a newborn. And I'm. But for me, it was like, I'm going to make this work. You know, I'm not going to come home like so many women that I had seen who had married American soldiers and came back home and then to hook up with the town guy. That wasn't going to be me. And so what I do, I stay there through all the abuse, and it's becoming really abusive. My ex-husband was also an alcoholic. I am drawn to alcoholics, and I'm drawn to people who struggle, remember? And at that point, I was drawn to people who struggle actively. I didn't know all of that. You know, this is sort of the things that come to us in recovery when we look at some of our behaviors as we work these steps. And so, you know, I don't need to go into all the details, but back and forth, you know, I'm trying to make this work. I see him being remorseful. So there is a moment there where we are just like, you know, we're happy together. And then just for him 2 days later to go back out to what I then found out was actually his ex-wife. You know, so there was some of that. And, you know, I go back home finally after a few months of I had enough. I go back home, and the moment I land, the phone rings, and I'm like, baby, I'm so sorry. I don't know what I did. Okay, I get back on the plane, go to Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to L.A. I'm back in California. That trip almost killed me. I started to use some other things that are sort of enhancing my restlessness. You know, and what I really find important, you know, as I read these little words that we have, or big words really, like restless, irritable, and discontent, I had that way before I ever took the first drink. Mm-hmm. You know, and I didn't know that then, but there was always what I seeked as adventure or you know, I was always restless, and to this day I have to really pay attention to that. Today I can be more aware, I have tools to work through it, but I find myself often just as edgy. If I don't watch it, I have to, and I don't need to take a drink over it today, thank God. But anyway, finally, this relationship ended. I left home, and just to kind of recreate, my mother tried everything. She got me into a job in Germany, in a hospital where I had a really, really good position. I rose kind of quickly there, even throughout all the partying, you know, I still apply myself at work. I think, you know, and at some point all of this partying is catching up with me again. You know, I have guys coming into this place and my mom is hearing about it. I'm shaming my parents. You know, my parents were terrified. Even when I was a kid, they threatened to send me away to an orphanage or to like a foster home. And I was like excited about that. You know, that sounded like a good idea for me. Maybe I meet more people like me, you know, because you guys are too straight. You don't get me. You know, so now I'm going back to Germany and I meet my second husband who I go to Chicago with. And in Chicago, it's basically the same thing. This person was not as abusive, but he was just as much of an alcoholic and other substances also. Very scary. When he sold the stove, I knew it was time to leave. The house was empty. At that time, I have two children. I have Sarah, who's four, and Lachey is just being born. And I remember we are in an empty house with a stove. And I look out the window, and he's pushing the stove. And I think this is that moment of clarity sometimes we hear about, you know, and I'm like, I can't stay here. This is going to kill me. And this is now, we are in Chicago and it's cold. It's not as tropical and sort of enticing as maybe California. I'm in the dead winter in Chicago and I'm intensely homesick. I had experience. I don't have depression, so I'm really grateful for that. But I had a depression at that time and I realized I needed to make a change. And I will say that all along, all in this time, I am the kind of alcoholic and also using other things to alter my mind that it's mostly prevalent when I'm in a relationship. I do not, I have long periods of sobriety when I'm not in a relationship. I'm also a member of Codependents Anonymous, and I believe that program saved my life, in addition to AA, of course, because it starts with abstinence, you know. But for me, I needed to take a look at the way I function in relationships, and I lose myself, you know, or I've lost myself. And so I become what you need me to be. And I remember so loudly speaking to my ex-husbands or any relationship I was in, but it was mostly when I already had children, that like, just use here, just drink here, because then I felt safe. You know what I mean? As long as you're right here with me doing it, I can do it with you. We're a team. You know, I mean, this doesn't all come out like that, but I'm like, just please stay. Use the house, you know, don't go out there where I don't know, just stay. So this is the kind of alcoholic I am. This is the kind of drinker that I am. And so, you know, but then I go to his mother and I'm like, look, I need to go. I say, I can't stay here. I have two children and I'm afraid it's going to kill me. And she says, I don't want to go home because, but I don't know what to do. You know, so I call my mom and she's like very aware of the way I behaved the last couple of times I came back to Germany. Nothing could hold me back, you know. She's like, she had enough, you know. And I'm so grateful that she didn't put up with me. You know what I mean? That she didn't say, well, come home, let's try it again, because I don't think anything changes. Nothing changes if nothing changes. So even though I was ready to come home at this time, she said, no, the reunification of Germany was happening. It was in 89. She's like, you won't find a place. See what else you can do. It kind of devastates me too when I look at it a little bit, because as I mentioned, I have children, and that's nothing I've ever told my kids. You know, I have pretty firm boundaries thanks to the program, but just to like, don't come back, I don't know. I'm grateful, but I don't know if I could have handled it this way. But anyway, it pushed me to Richmond. I had a friend who lived in Richmond, and she said, why don't you just come? Now, I don't have a dollar to my name, and so I go to his mother, and I say, I'm ready to leave. Nothing will happen here. I'm afraid it's going to kill me, and she reminds me that she will buy me the ticket, but I have to take her son. So I'm getting on the bus with the person I'm trying to get away from, and that was in December of 89. I came. I did not know that I was pregnant with my third daughter. And so I find myself really, I'm thinking that we have an opportunity to stay with this person, and we're not. This person is really not capable or able. The landlord lived below. She said, I tell you what, I wanted you to come, but you can't stay here. So now I'm homeless. My ex-husband gets locked up, I think, 2 days after we get to Richmond for stealing something. You know, I don't know, maybe shoplifting a 40. I'm not really sure, but I do know that this was a turning point in my life, the first turning point. I found myself with two kids, not knowing I was pregnant at the time, as I mentioned, and I ended up in a homeless shelter on Porter Street in Richmond, Virginia, and that was a really dark time for me. Because initially my friends said, the kids can stay, but you guys can't. I can't have, you know, I can't afford being kicked out. So I slept in the hallways even by myself for a while. And in the morning I was back on the door just with, you know, being there for my kids. And so I end up in this shelter. And long story short, we bounce back and forth a few times with these one-night shelters only, you know, and then I find a place in the emergency shelter on Fuji in Maine, and my kids and I feel for the first time really, like, not only together again. I mean, not that they were ever really away from me other than those nights when they were staying with my friend, but, you know, I just couldn't imagine not having them close to me. So the shelter was a good deal to me. It was a shelter for abused women, and I was able to get some kind of semi-permanent residence. And after a few weeks, you had to make an effort there. You had to either look for two job opportunities and one opportunity to find a place. But see, I never did anything right. I never had my social security number. I just married. And you would not get automatic permanent residency by just marrying. You know, that changed years ago. So I was now at this time on an expired visitor visa. And so I couldn't make any effort because I was an illegal alien. And so I came, and the director from the program came to me, and she offered me a place in her home. She said, you're a little different than, your circumstances are different. I would like to offer you a place in my home until you can deliver Eliza. By that time, maybe you can look into your paperwork, and in exchange, maybe you can watch my two children. You know, I have long work hours. And that was a saving grace. I had consistency. I stayed at Sadie's house until August. And then I had gotten my papers together, you know, and slowly but surely my life was starting to look a little bit normal. And at that time, I don't drink. I don't have any kind of a, I'm not drinking, I'm not using, I'm not doing anything. I'm just focusing on what I need to focus on. However, that changes the moment my husband comes back out and we're just like that again. But I had enough of a moment there where I just knew that this is not the life I wanted to live. And as I mentioned, my husband in and out back and forth. And so I got pregnant again. You know, there's a lot of that. You know, I know that there's birth control, but I guess I didn't care for it. And I will say this, these were not accidents. I wanted to have a big family. You know, none of my children were unwanted or not planned. I knew that if anything, I wanted to be a mother. Don't ask me where that came from. I didn't have a close relationship with my mom, but I wanted something for myself. And most people probably get a puppy, you know, but for me, it's like I have to have my dogs, I mean, my kids. And so there's that. And what changed for me, and this is where we move into the, you know, what happened is after the birth of my last daughter, I was diagnosed at a regular checkup with hepatitis C. Which I contracted in California in a really dark parlor to get a tattoo. And this is the only thing I can imagine because I never shot up, but I did that, you know, and so I think at that time none of these places were really screened the way they are now. And so, you know, I went to this treatment and they tell me that, you know, I probably would experience intense fatigue, flu-like symptoms, and I'm like, you know, I can't afford that. I'm a single parent of five at that time. And I just can't afford to be down like that. So for 1 year, I tried really hard to get well on my own. It changed my life. While it didn't put a dent in my viral load, it did get me really strong for the treatment, which I would ultimately take in 99. I was diagnosed with a very favorable genotype, which basically cured my hep C within weeks. But what really happened there is my physician tells me that, like, if you want this treatment, you know, they ask you all these routine questions, do you drink recreational drugs, alcohol? And I could say yes, yes, yes. And he's like, if you want this treatment, the one thing you cannot do is drink. And so, you know, I said, no problem. And this is when I put a drink down, never to pick it up again. But if you remember, my sobriety date is much later because, once again, you know, I need to alter. But with alcohol, this was my final. I remember going out one more time, just really hitting it hard, waking up really cotton mouth, you know, and knowing that I'm going to, you know, do this treatment. And as I was going through this treatment, you know, everything was starting to look really good. I had no side effects whatsoever, and I really credit that to having had that 1 year of really strengthening myself with the things that were available to me without prescription, like dandelion, artichoke, whatever it is that I studied about, you know, prepared me to be really strong and resilient for the treatment. And so here I am, you know, I'm getting better, and I am licensed with the state of Virginia to be a daycare provider, so I now become self-employed. Which for 11 years I had a daycare. I'm really grateful. We moved into our house when Nadia was born in 98. It's the house I'm still in. You know, I like to share a little bit about what it was like for me to still, I guess, not have a program, but not drinking either. You know, and I hear the term dry drunk and miserable. I have to say, it didn't occur to me until very recently that my children were my higher power. For my children, I would do anything. So for me, it was so important to see them. I was active on every school board. I was volunteering. I was able to get them in the best camps. If you ask my kids today, they would tell you that they had a really good childhood. I mean, my oldest remembers some of the insanity I drank and drove. And I'm going to tell you that I never had any consequence, but that's not because I walked the straight and narrow. It's just because I was really lucky. You know what I mean? I remember one morning waking up and I look out the window and the van isn't there and I have no memory of where I parked it. But I do remember us coming home from the pool, you know, and I had a car full of kids, even other people's kids. And yet, you know, so that was kind of backtracking a little bit. But yes, so I just, you know, my life is good. You know, I realized that things are going well. And in 2008, I do want to pursue a childhood dream because I left so early and I made so many insane decisions. I want to go to college. You know, I had gone to the Folk Fest in Richmond and I seen this sign language interpreter doing this concert and I fell in love with the language and I thought it was a good idea and I educated myself. I enrolled in college in 2008 and I loved the way that felt, you know, doing something a little bit for me that felt really good. And I also realized right there as I sit on my desk that everybody is able to pay really good attention, but I can't. And it's not that I'm not wanting to, because I'm taking this serious at this time. This is not high school. I'm in college now, and I want to do this, and I cannot focus. I read a page. It takes me forever to read a page. And I realized that maybe I have what two of my children had been diagnosed with, which is ADHD, if you want to put a label on it, you know. And so I go to my doctor, who's an addiction specialist, and I share with her that I'm struggling. And she says, Petra, there's great stuff out there for that. You know, you don't have to struggle like that. There's something out there that will help you stimulate, and, you know, your mind will work better. You know, we can try that. We'll monitor it. You know, we'll do it safely. And I took one, and I sat in this classroom, and I have to tell you, it felt like the angels were singing to me. All of a sudden, all of this restlessness, this chaotic mind that I've had for most of my life, even not drinking, there's still that insane drive always, which kind of keeps me focused, because I am not only self-will run riot, which can serve me to some degree. Let's not forget that it kept me and my kids together. So that is a result of intense control. You know what I mean? I'm willing to go to any length. There's very little room for God here. You know, I was brought up my mother is a very loyal Christian, and I was brought up with some of these teachings, and I believe that, but I don't rely on it. And so I rely on me, self-reliance, which makes it really hard for me to then actually connect to a program that ultimately expects me to admit that I'm powerless over anything, which is going to come in a little while. And oh boy, did I fight that one. But I had to have another experience that would humble me forever. Because you see, putting down the drink for me was not hard. And if it had stopped there, I probably never would have found AA. Because that wasn't hard for me. In college, you know, as I mentioned, I go to college, I take one, I feel really good. But in no time, I'm abusing it. I think a week later, I'm taking 3, 4, and I'm feeling like a superstar. And this is not inflated. I am feeling I can multitask with the best of them. I don't ever eat, so I'm super thin. I feel really hot, you know. There is all of that. And people are like, you look great. You get so many things done. And I'm like, yeah, you know. And I have to tell you, throughout all of my college, I did nothing but the dean's list. You know, I was a great studier. But it almost killed me two years later, in 2010. So that humbled me. You know, I remember one morning not being able to function, you know. My heart, I had to pull over to a local Walmart because I delivered bagels at 3 a.m. just to make all these ends meet with college and everything. And I remember pulling over with the company van in a Walmart that had a blood pressure taker, and my blood pressure was 155 over 160, I think. And this was all by stimulating myself. You know what I mean? And I knew if something didn't happen, I would probably die. And I've never had that feeling with alcohol. Alcohol was a party to me. It led to other things, which wasn't a party. But to me, in my memory, with all of this, there was still plenty of a euphoric recall, if you may want to call it that. But the other abuse or misuse or addiction humbled me greatly. And so at the time I enrolled in college, I also met Jerry, and he was, of course, in AA. And so because I told you how I function in relationships, I want to be a part of, I'm going to meetings now, because he's in meetings and it brings us closer. So I go to meetings and I cannot relate to anything that you guys share, because in my mind, I am sober. You know what I mean? I never had a struggle with drinking. I heard some of these stories from women who would lose their children, had car crashes, end up in jail. And I think to some degree I had a disdain for that. You know what I mean? It was like, really? Well, you must have not tried hard enough. I would have never admitted that to you, but I think there was a part of me that thought that way. And that's why I had to have the other experience, you know. But I realized I was invited to go for my first international convention in San Antonio, and I felt really disconnected. I had never felt what people refer to as being a part of, that coming home kind of feeling. I never had that, up until that point at least. And I spent most of that convention time at the pool. you know what I mean, at the hotel pool, because I've seen everybody run around with these name tags, and it didn't feel good to me, you know, it didn't feel like a lie, you know, and I wasn't, and at that time, actually, I was still using. But I find myself, you know, finally wanting to do this right. I found a sponsor, and I picked up my first white chip that first of January, because I think the night before I smoked hash. You know, it really woke me up that I'm still resorting to that without consequences, without considering the consequences. And I never liked that kind of thing, but at that night it seemed like a good idea, and that kind of scared me a little bit, even if it was something just mild, if you may, like that. And I heard enough in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that a drug is a drug is a drug. You know, and I think that's from here. Maybe it's another program, but, you know, so I do find myself now really plugging in. I also find myself looking at my codependency, and my dog is my light bringer. She broke my leg in three places, and I couldn't walk for just about 8 months, and at that time I realized that some things were fundamentally wrong with me. I got a therapist. I started to work really intensely on everything that I needed to look at, and it changed my life. I never made it to be a sign language interpreter. I realized that input process output with my ADHD mind does not work. I get way too frazzled. But one thing that really came to me, I had been introduced to yoga after the birth of my kid by one of the parents that already changed my life on a personal level. Because it gave me a bit of serenity. On the mat, I felt like I could have some space between the ears. But as I took an elective, I took yoga, it seemed like an easy class, and this teacher in there, you know, said I should certainly consider the teacher training, not because my practice was so gorgeous, but because of somebody's life experiences, you know, addictions, domestic violence, you know, whatever it is that I had experienced. She said, if you take that on the mat, you know, other people can really benefit from that. And so this really turned out well for me. And so while I didn't graduate with that, you know, this has become, and is to this day, not only my passion, it is what changes, what gives me clarity and just changes me on a physical and mental and spiritual level. What it is like now, I tell you something. One practice ground for me forever has been my children. Up until very recently, I think that need to control all of the environment, all of the circumstances, to been in place to look after so many lives, certainly transitioned into their teenage years where it still needed some guidance and overseeing, but now into adulthood, I'm still not able to detach. Now, I have fabulous people that I've raised. I have to tell you that, and I'm not saying that because they're mine. They're compassionate people. They have a love for life. But I have one child that drinks alcoholically and another one that I think is. Yeah, I think it's fair to say I have two alcoholic children. And I tell you, that is a heartbreak to me. It was up until I really just, it sat with me the other day. There were so many times I couldn't quite identify myself as an alcoholic. And that's, I'm not saying that I'm not, but because it almost seemed easy to put that down back then, I couldn't quite relate. But I had heard so many wonderful testimonies from young men, young women, who had terrible drinking careers, drinking that took them to the edge of insanity. And that is my son. He is one of the brightest people I know. He is one of the most charismatic people I know. And he can do very, very good for a long time. And then he wakes up in a jail in Virginia Beach after his birthday with a broken hand. And if I hadn't heard you share about that, I would have thought it was a matter of willpower once again. You know what I mean? So I am now benefiting from everything I've heard in AA, not only for me, because I am, by the grace of God, learning to trust in something beyond my own capability. And I tell you, that is just a beautiful way to live for me today. And yet there was always this struggle with my children where I'm like, if they only like are there, then I can finally relax. And I am there today, even though not everything is perfect. The one thing I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, that everything is in divine order. Divine, regardless of appearance. And interestingly enough, the moment I let go, I take my hand off the project. God can move in. God wants permission. The best thing I've ever heard in a program, in a room, was God is not a bully. He wants to be invited in. And I have to remember that this is how I need to do my relationship with my higher power. My higher power is, doesn't need, I don't need to ask it, because I believe that we are filled with spirit. I believe that. But we need to be humbled in prayer, connecting in meditation. And this is where I find my way to operate, if you may, because I am still very self-reliant. So if there is too much Petra, there can't be God, because there's just not enough space in this. You know what I mean? So I have to trust that today. And this is, you know, not only in the morning, I'm not a kneeling kind of girl. Let's put it that way. But I do, when I open my eyes, I give God thanks for my body functioning, because I was also diagnosed with cancer, and I want to share this briefly because it made a big difference. AA was there for me all the way. I was diagnosed, I think it was 2014, you know, with a very aggressive cancer that would have, I was told that if I don't have surgery right away, I probably wouldn't have much longer. So this was all, and you know, I was so prepared to go into this treatment. Because by that time, I didn't have only enough program, I had enough God in my life that I knew no matter what happened. It also helped that my kids were older. It wasn't like with the Hep C thing where my baby had just been born. They were older. I was more matured in my spirituality. I knew that nothing happens by mistake. That doesn't mean I didn't get maybe uneasy at times, but I will tell you, and this is not being cocky, I was not fearful. Because I knew that everything would be okay regardless of appearance. And this is what I've learned here. I've learned it in other practices. And so, you know, this was really important to me. I kind of lost my train a little bit of thought. But, you know, just talking about what it is like now, I know that my relationships with everybody really benefit from letting go. You know, it's not by trying harder. It's by trusting that not every relationship is meant to be and meant to last. You know, this is something that's coming to me very recently. I don't own my kids. They don't own me. You know what I mean? I have the privilege of guiding them and supporting them. Whatever choices they make, they will need. I want to say that I have a most amazing relationship with my parents today. My mom didn't want to see me because, oh my God, she didn't know what came around the corner when she seen me. I get to go home every year, 1 month, just about 3 weeks. And my mom is almost fighting with my dad, who lives with his husband in my family home. And they have a wonderful relationship, but they almost fight over me. And I love it. So my dad gets the bicycle ready, because that's the little town I grew up in. High school, it's funny because, you know, I was that person that always edged on and didn't want to fit in. They have a little special high school reunion for me every year when I come. You know, it's small, it's intimate, it's about 20 of us. But we get together, and they actually credit Petra for coming, that everybody gets together again. And I didn't know that they don't really have that thread with each other, you know. And this is what I'm learning here. I'm learning to play with others, you know. I've always been a lone wolf, and I thought that was such a cool way to be, you know what I mean? And I liked the way it felt, you know, I guess that rebel with a cause, you know. It's a lonely way to age, though. I tell you one thing, it might be somewhat glorious when you're young, but it does suck when you get older and your kids leave, and then you have that empty nest, and you want them to call you or text you, and they don't, because they have a right to live their own lives without reporting to me. I want to tell you the biggest gift to me I have learned in sobriety has happened just about a week ago. I mentioned to you that my son drinks alcoholically, and he struggles. When he drinks like that, he doesn't come because he doesn't want me to see him that way. None of my kids need me for anything. I want to say this too. One of my kids is in Hawaii right now. They've made their way. They live good lives. But this one guy, my guy, he drinks like that, you know, and then he wakes up in places with his body just out of shape. And then he doesn't come around. And my youngest has to remind me, she says, you know, Mom, when he's doing these things, he doesn't come because he doesn't want to face you. And I don't preach AA to them. I want to tell you, I did that in the beginning. The best way to get somebody not sober is to preach AA to them, right? Especially as their parent. I think it's really important to just be a recovering parent. And my sponsor reminded me of that. She reminded me, because everything went just crazy for a long time still with me and my emotions, she reminded me. She said, Petra, I said, why? I'm being sober here and everything is falling apart. I mean, I had the feds outside. I had the narcs outside with 10 cars escorting my son out of the house one time. I mean, it was just like, I wasn't brought up that way. And while I'm adventurous, none of that I do. You know, I do obey the law still. I might be defiant, but I obey the law. And here is that kid of mine. So what is happening here is like, I had to go to God. Because I don't want to push him away and alienate him and set more boundaries. Because I've learned a lot of that in these programs, that boundaries are important. But I'm like, I want to be also a person. Not just somebody who has firm boundaries and until you get that way, you know. And my son came to me, and financially secure, so it doesn't come from a place of need, you know, like not knowing where to go. He basically expressed to me that he thought he would benefit from being closer to home. I have to tell you, I took that as a great compliment. And it wouldn't have happened because I was so afraid of losing my serenity again. And then I realized I don't need to remove the wreckage of the future. That's the one thing that came to mind. I want to deal with life as life happens today. And we sat together and we talked about some of the things that must be in place when you come to an arrangement like that. At this point, I am delighted to report that everything is good. I love knowing that he's there, but it's not in a way that I can control his behavior. You know what? I don't even check in. I told him, I said, I am not the mother here. I said, if this is support, it also supports me. You know, financially, he takes care of most of the bills, which is wonderful. He paid that in his penthouse. He says, and he let this is so wonderful because the entire family heals. And I don't need to get into every little detail, but what I really find is as alcoholics in recovery, not only do we recover, our families recover. We read it in the family afterwards. And there is still that tornado, and I find, you know, when it talks about the reconstruction phase is long or something like that, you know, since chemo, I don't have any brain, very little memory to recall things like that. But I do remember reading that, and I'm like, and what my sponsor said back then, she said, you know what? It might be like that. It might still be crazy, but you're an example of a sober mother. So that has to be enough. So over the years, you know, I have learned that regardless of appearance, everything is a divine. And I trust that as I pray and ask God for guidance, that he will allow me to be. And today I feel a softness instead of a fear. And I felt fearful for a long time. And I tell you, one of my biggest triggers still to this day is sirens. When I hear a siren, it's like I'm like my dog when it thunders. I want to hide in the bathtub. I never thought of that, but that's kind of cute. Especially if you know my dog. But I just, you know, it's. I think allowing God in every part of my life has been one of the biggest gifts that I've learned here. I've learned through so many shares that just when you think, and sometimes I remember, just before it gets light, it's really dark. My prayer is only that my family is a testimony to recovery, that we are free from compulsive, obsessive behaviors, however they manifest. You know, I tell you one thing, I do really good today, but the one thing that still gets me, and I know this is not OA, I eat sugar. The moment I hit it, I lose everything. I can wake up in a blackout sugar, you know, sugar blackout. So I have to really, like, all of these things are a manifestation of still the more disease. You know what I mean? I have that disease of more. And I only have the privilege of staying connected. I am active in service, maybe not as much as some. I know some people are forever everywhere. I carry a meeting to the psychiatric ward the last Wednesday of the month. I sponsor international and locally. Very grateful what I've learned there. With so many women from all around. I sponsor maybe a bit unorthodox. I don't know what to compare it to, but I certainly don't sponsor the way I was sponsored. For my first sponsor, she was somewhat rigid. I needed that, and I love her, and I'm still in touch with her today, but she was very like, I'm not your friend. I am your sponsor. And I'm like, okay. And yet I had established a relationship with that woman that I needed so much because my mom, I had left her. You know, I really left my mom when I was 14. Even before then. Not necessarily physical, but later, you know. But emotional, that's for sure. And so, you know, this woman became really important to me. I say, but I realized that this woman was not really as involved as I wanted her to be in AA. And this was only for my own sake, because I just wanted to be, I've seen all of these places women would go with their sponsees and their sponsors, and my sponsor was never there. So I stepped out, which I know to be a really courageous act, because I felt so connected to that woman, I knew I wasn't getting everything I needed in AA. And so I actively sought out a new sponsor. And this woman is today still my sponsor. And I believe that I'm friends with my sponsees. We share something so intimate. How can I not consider that a valuable friendship, a valuable relationship? You know, I am, however, also aware that I need to be able to call out things that they may not see. So it's a huge responsibility, and I am grateful. And I know none of this until I go in prayer. I want to say this too. I can educate myself. I can intellectualize this thing. I can analyze it. I am very mindful that wherever I step, I allow God in. And you know what? I don't do this perfect. I forget it. And I'm reminded why I need to do it, because I do forget it. And then I am like, all of a sudden it seems like a therapy session, and I'm like, wait a minute, not there. So we kind of go back a little bit, and I'm honest with my sponsors. I said, dude, you know, I'm just another woman in recovery, you know, with the privilege to support you. Recovery changed my life. Obviously, you know, you all know that. I don't need to tell you that, but it's still changing everything. And I just love the way it feels not to hold on so hard. You know, not to hold on and control all the outcomes. And I think that is a result of my higher power present in my life. Because if I trust that everything is the way it needs to be, and that there is divine purpose and guidance, then I don't need to orchestrate everything. I'm not as fearful of losing people, as I mentioned earlier, you know, and I think some of it may be because I've faced death a few times, like most of us have, but with me it was in addition with illnesses also, and, you know, relationships where I would do anything. Today I'm a bit defiant, and I have a very loving partner who's able to support me through that from the very beginning, very patient, and I'm grateful for the program. I can't imagine what it would be like to see someone who is not in the program. I don't have experience with it, but I do know one thing, if I am dating again, if I need to at some point, or will, then I know that I will not use with you to be a part of. I will always have to stay connected to AA. It's a lot easier with my partner being there, because he has a tremendous respect for the time it takes sometimes. I had a sponsee session this morning at 8, and you know, it's Sunday morning, but you do what you do, because without that I have no life. My life is based on service. I'm, you know, and in AA, absolutely, but not only AA. I'm really grateful to say that I am loved in the yoga community. I have the privilege to sharing it with so many different people, not only in a way that it's like physical, but really from the heart. Women who've experienced a lot of trauma, and men as well, but my home groups, my home studio is basically just women. And this is a place where we feel safe, and I learned all that along the way. All of my pain has contributed to the Petra I am today, and I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a thing. It needed to be exactly that way, regardless of appearance. Namaste.